Hello, I'm David Hurrian. Up until recently, I was the deputy editor of Gardeners World magazine, a magazine you might have heard of. I have always been a gardener. I've gardened since I was about 5 years old. Started my career by crawling off into flower beds when I was even younger than that and eating worms. Never did me any harm, honestly. And I've always been a mad keen, passionate gardener and been lucky enough to be horticulturally trained and make a career in my favourite hobby.
My name is Matthew Biggs. As I was just been saying to Nick Hamilton here on my left, that I have been demoted to undergardener in my own garden since my wife has taken a passionate interest in the garden itself. So when I'm allowed, I am out there gardening. I trained, as David did, professionally, studying at Pershore and Kew. So fortunate to be indulging in horticulture as a job. Over the years, I've done all sorts of things, from show gardens to TV directing of gardening programmes, and that is just the CV of a freelancer. But always, whenever I put a list of things that I've done, I am a gardener at heart, and that is the key. And it's so much fun. It's about excitement, it's about satisfying your curiosity, it's about experimentation, and there is no such thing as failure, because it all adds to your bank of experience that makes you a better gardener in the long term. So, yeah, I'm Matt Biggs, and I'm having fun.
I am a gardener.
And I'm Jonathan Brocklebank. I'm the head gardener at Barnsdale. I came here in March 1995, so 30 years next year. And I've seen it all here. I've seen it develop over the years, all kinds of weather. It's always interesting. Every day is different. That's about me. I'm Barnsdale through and through.
So I'm Nick Hamilton. I'm the boss. I did have a badge that said, Nick, I'm the boss. And nobody took a blind bit of notice. So I took it off. John worked with my dad, as did I, for 7 years. So I've been here for 35 years. Been in horticulture for 44 professionally. And as with everybody else, been interested from a young child. But we do what we do here at Barnsdale, which is really education, I think. You know, teach people what to do, produce lovely gardens. And John, obviously, and his team and everybody else that's here works very hard in order to do that. So I'm in charge as well today of all of this. So the panellists are going to have to do as they're told. And we hope for some very good and very interesting questions. So has anybody got something really juicy to start with?
Hi, my name's Charlotte and I live in Wardley, just near Uppingham, so just down the road. I used to live in Pennsylvania on the east coast of the States, and in both the gardens that I had there, we had flowering dogwood trees, which I absolutely adore. We moved to this area only about 6 months ago, so I've got a huge garden to fill, and one of the things I'd really like to do is to put Cornucusa in. Do you have any success growing them around here or in the UK? Because I just don't see them very often. And what particular Cornucusa would you recommend I try?
So I've seen them this year more than I've ever seen them before. So I've been lucky enough to be going around garden visiting with groups, escorting them, and particularly down in the southeast in Kent and Sussex, there were masses of them in flower. They all seem to be planted about 20 years ago and all beginning to reach maturity, and absolutely, it was definitely the year for Cornucusa. I don't see why you shouldn't succeed with them. They don't really like getting bone dry at the roots when they're young. They need, you know, encouragement to get established. I've got two in my garden. What's your soil like?
Fairly dry.
Okay. Yeah.
So
decent-ish soil, but it prone. So that's the key thing, is when you're taking out a planting hole, I would try and put some decent organic matter into that planting hole. Not to the extent that you're trying to encourage the roots to stay in that planting hole, you know.
No.
And then mulch around the base of it every year would be a good advice. So I've got two in my garden. My favourite of those two is one called Miss Sowry, which is a really, really lovely one.
Missouri, as in
Missouri. Miss Satomi. Satomi.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I've got that completely wrong.
Okay.
Yes,
I've
sorry.
Heard of that one, yeah.
You're on the Woody Plant Committee, that's why you know that.
No, I was that.
But there is one called something Sowry as well, isn't
yes,
there?
Is.
And I, yeah, but anyway, Miss Satomi, that's the one that I've got that I really love.
And is it white or pink?
It goes a subtle pink colour. It's not the strongest pink that there is, but it turns from that lovely creamy white to a pinky colour.
Mm.
Just to say that also in Hertfordshire, not in my garden, but I noticed one in our village, just as David said, they're popping up. And what a great plant to pop up. You mentioned some of the characteristics, and you know them well from your garden in Pennsylvania, but anybody who doesn't know them, they have little clusters of flowers, like a little central boss of flowers, and beautiful large bracts around the outside, which make it look like a big flower. And when they flower, they're absolutely covered in flowers. You get a cloud of flowers, and that's what makes them so attractive. Then, if you have Cornuscusa chinensis, they are followed by red fruits that hang on quite long stems, which are rather sort of lumpy and sort of warty and bright pink. So they're very attractive, and you get good autumn colour from them as well. So it's a really good plant to grow. So I would just go for the straight chinensis. And I'm only doing that because David has nicked the best one. But I think that's by far the best one, Mr. Tomey.
And just quickly as well, I've just looked it up and I was getting muddled up with a hydrangea, Miss Sowry.
That's all
so
right.
It's a hydrangea that's Miss Sowry, sorry. So it's right. Satomi.
Okay. Would you like to grow hydrangeas?
Yeah, I'll do that as well, yeah.
They do well for you as well.
Just to make it a little bit more local.
We have a couple here. We have John Slowcock, up in the winter border.
Okay.
And that went in 2017, and it's flowered really well at flowering time every year, and this year it was covered. Like David said, they do need, I think, good moisture around them until they've got a good root system. Yeah. And when we planted ours, it did have the fruits on, they're like golf ball size, as Matt said, orangey pink, really beautiful. And I collected the seed off that and grew some more, and I've dotted those around, and they're doing well. But yeah, let them dry out, I'd say, when they're young.
Sorry, one thing we sort of have missed out. We talked about the ground conditions, and after planting, I'd definitely mulch them. The other thing is they like a little bit of sunshine, you know, dappled shade, and a sheltered spot if you can, which is quite remarkable because this is an exposed garden, and yet yours are flowering, I assume. Have you managed to find a nice spot for them?
Well, yeah, as you say, not in full bright sunlight. They're better in a bit dappled, maybe. I don't like it too blazing. Well, where we've put them, they're in slightly sheltered spots.
Okay. It's a sort of edge of woodland type of environment, isn't it, really? Mm-hmm. You know, in the garden here, I think it's the same as any garden. I mean, ours is just over 8 acres, and within that, we've got exposed bits, we've got more sheltered areas, and I think also with the way that certain areas are planted, that creates shelter as well, and something a little bit better. And as John said, I mean, the winter border's in a fairly good situation for that John Slowcock, which is a fabulous variety, it really is. But
just while we're on the subject, I've been looking around my own garden. We're quite high up. As I mentioned, we're in Hertfordshire on the west side. And you do start to notice the microclimates within your own garden. Mm. And I think it's really interesting because you think, oh, yeah, we're high up. Everything's going to be sort of be caught by the southwest wind. But when you start to look carefully and go and stand in your garden or sit in your garden, you find there's little places down by my office where the wind eddies around, where it gets just fleeting sunshine. There's another corner that's very, very protected. You notice where the shadows are for the shade. So before you start sort of planting your garden, or when you're going to start planting, then do start having a look round at these microclimates. And Peter Gibbs, the weatherman who chairs Gardeners Question Time, he does a talk on microclimates within the garden that I've yet to hear, but it would be very interesting. Well, David's a weatherman as well, so he will know more than I do about microclimates, but they are very interesting to study within their own garden. I'd like to hear Peter's talk, but I'm sure David would be equally as interesting.
You know, I think it would make life a lot easier if, just as the weather forecasters do on their maps, that your garden, actually the air was coloured. So you could see coloured blue, dark blue where it was colder, and red or where it was warmer. It would make life easier, but it is important to know where those little shelter spots are.
I think also, just to really drive it home, if you haven't got any shelter and you haven't got any dappled shade, it might be that initially, to sate your appetite for them, you plant one sort of perhaps on the northern side of your house, so it gets a shelter from the worst of the southwest wind, and just somewhere where it gets sun for part of the day, because the north aspect of most people's gardens, if you've got a north-facing aspect, it's surprising how much sunlight they get first thing in the morning and last thing at night, because the sun rises in the northeast and sets in the northwest, And when we do most of our planting, which is in the winter months, and we think about redesigning our gardens, we often go out and look at the garden, and that's the time of year when the sun rises in the southeast and sets in the southwest. So you never think that that north-facing aspect is going to get any sun at all. And of course, from March to September, before you get up in the morning, the sun is blazing on that north wall and blazing on it in the evening. So it's interesting, and that's a really good location for those corners because they're getting part sun, part shade.
Okay, thank you.
Right, so we've got somebody just over at the end there with a burning question to ask.
Hello, I'm Nicola. We moved to a new house in London a couple of years ago, so we have a new garden. And it relates a bit to your question in terms of ground cover for shady areas. So the garden is southwest facing, but there's a fence that is mostly in the shade during the day. So how to deal, you know, with a new bed and wanting some pretty ground cover. And also slug proof, if possible. A big issue with slugs and snails.
Can I add to that as well? When you pick up the slugs, what do you do with them?
Two questions.
Oh, there are. There's a contentious question. Right, OK. So would you like to start, Matt, with some plants for ground cover in the shade?
Not really. but I will. So in the shade, obviously it's dry shade. You think about rain shadows. We're just talking about weather and people forget about the rain shadows created by walls and fences. So for dry shade, geraniums are a really good group of plants for ground cover and for, you know, good interest, almost year-round interest, because some of them are evergreen and have red foliage in the wintertime. So in the dry spot, there's a lot of nice geranium phaeums, which is known as the morning widow geranium. Geranium phaeum samobore has purple blotches on the leaves and very dark coloured flowers with these petals that fold right back. That does well. If you can improve the soil, by the way, with well-rotted or rotted organic matter, that does help the plants. So you can improve the soil, first of all, because they do prefer a little bit of moisture. But once they get going, they're absolutely fine in dry shade. There is another cultivar called Lily Lovell, which is my favourite, and that has a slate lilac coloured flower.
You make it sound so lovely, but no, it is a really nice colour.
I'm part of its PR team.
It's sort of the colour, a mixture of the colour of your tops, isn't it, really, interestingly? Yeah, it's a lovely colour.
So you would like that. It's all in terribly good taste. That is nice. Now, they're not hugely floriferous, but they are very, very pretty. So I would look at those. I was looking recently, actually. There are more cultivars than I had realised, but those are the two that I particularly like. Mm. There's also a geranium Canterbury-gens called St. Ola, which is ground cover and evergreen and goes red in the winter, and that sort of has white flowers too. Brunneras would grow well, Jack Frost. And again, what you get with those is the blue Myosotis flowers, a little bit like forget-me-not flowers in the spring, and silvery Venetian on the leaves. So those three to start off with are. Oh, I tell you what, beg your pardon, can I just add one more? I once saw Liriope Big Boy, and it was growing at the base of a yew tree, which I thought was extraordinary. So they have grassy-like foliage and spikes of deep lavender purple flowers, which are very upright, very vertical. And I did see a picture, I've not seen it in reality, of a garden in the States where they'd crammed like loads of them together under the shade of trees. And it looked like the equivalent of our bluebells. I'd never seen anything like it. You know, they ran them together in a big, big area. And, of course, they all flowered at once with these quite strongly coloured flowers. And they were really good. And another one that I've got is Ophiopogon, the Paniscapum var nigrescens, which is a similar thing, but that's much lower growing. I remember that one, by the way, because when I was a student, somebody had lifted a manhole cover. The leaves had gone under the manhole cover, and when we lifted it again, instead of being black, very, very dark purple, they were green. It's like magic. That's a great party trick.
Yeah.
It's
what they call the black grass, isn't it, the Ophiopogon? It actually is a perennial and not a grass. So not on the website I have now, the web shop I have now, but the previous web shop I had, I I had to put it in the grass section as well as the perennial section, because you want to be officially right, but also everybody's looking in the grass section for it, so you had to have it in both. It's one of those odd things. So, John?
Well, yeah, geraniums, definitely. So many different colours and shapes. One that I really like is actually growing just at the back here with a pale purpley flower. I can't pronounce the name. Nick maybe can. It's the
Vlasovianum.
That's the one.
Vlasovianum. It starts WL. A-double-S, so it's yes, it's a bit of a mouthful, but a lovely plant. It
gets really good autumn colour. The leaves go quite red, so that's an added bonus on that one. Epimediums, I find, do really well in dry shade as well. They're an evergreen perennial, which really you need to cut the leaves back sort of late autumn and into the winter. The leaves will change colour, but then you cut them back and then the flowers come up in the early spring, which are very dainty, and they come in a range of colours. Orange Queen is a really good one, but there are lots of different ones.
Can I suggest Geranium nodosum as well? So all the nodosum types are really, really tolerant of shady conditions and tough growing conditions. I think what I would say is that if you've got any conditions that you think are really challenging, like dry shade, the shade is enough for the plant to deal with on its own, and you can broaden your repertoire of plants if you improve that soil. So I think key to success is making it sort of what's called woodsy, which means adding either leaf mould or well-rotted compost or some organic matter, plenty of organic matter, to that soil to make it like you would find in a wood, which is why I tend to refer to it as woodsy soil. And you can really then expand what you can grow. And I've been doing that under some well-established shrubs, which have taken quite a lot of goodness out of the soil, but I mulch regularly. And I've started experimenting with all sorts of different things in that sort of shady understory, if you like. And one of the ones I really, really rate, that most people really haven't heard of, is a pilea. So do you know the house plant, the pilea, that's the aluminium plant? There are now hardy pileas that are being introduced from Taiwan. And there's one called Pilea Taiwan Silver to look out for, which is a really lovely foliage plant with silvery variegation on the leaf. The leaf is probably about 3 centimetres long and about 2 centimetres wide with slightly toothed edge. Pilea Taiwan Silver, I'll let you in on a big secret, it roots in water. The stems root in water really well, so it's really easy to bulk up. And then the other thing that I've been growing in that sort of semi-shady, dryish conditions is another unusual group of plants called bomerias. And they're related to nettles. Sounds really exciting, doesn't it? But they're very attractive nettles. They come in all shapes and sizes with really interesting leaf shapes. So that's B-O-E-H-M-E-R-I-A, bomeria. And start looking into those because they're interesting. And then the other thing that I really rate for dryish shade are hardy begonias, so Begonia evansii, which is remarkably tough and robust and is a really nice foliage plant during the summer. And then right at the end of the season, in about late September, October, it starts producing begonia flowers, and it propagates itself around with little cormlet things that it drops off the stems. They drop to the ground. They're like big buds that sit in the leaf axils. They drop off, sit on the ground, and then germinate, in inverted commas, next year, grow into new plants. So you quite quickly develop a nice little community of them. And all of those things have got really nice foliage, because I think rather than trying to get lots of flower in shade, you often want to get leaf cover and ground cover, like you suggest. And those things have got quite graphic, nice leaves that will look good. And then now and again, the odd flower as well.
I've got the begonias and they are really, really good. And what is it, August, a month, started flowering sort of early. Beautiful pink flowers. There's a white form as well. But the lovely thing about the list that David has also given you is taking advantage of the fact that you're gardening in London and the warmth of the microclimate. And I did notice that, Nick, when you mentioned the, what was the silver? The pilea.
Oh, yeah.
Nick noted that down because he probably must get that in
I'll
stock.
Send you some cuttings, Nick. It's really good plant, yeah. It's called Pilea Matsudanai Taiwan Silver. And that one, in my experience, is the hardiest one of the other. There are quite a few that I'm experimenting with as well, but that one is amazingly tough. So not this winter just gone, the previous winter, I'd only just put some young plants in. We got that, do you remember that late frost? It went on and on, the summer went on and on, and then November it suddenly went like an episode of Colditz. It went really cold and freezing, and they all just went to mush, that Taiwan silver, and I thought, oh, well, that's the end of those. The following spring, they came back like an eruption from the ground, and it just proved to me that they're hardier than you think. So,
I tell you what else, just thinking of ground colours that are quite pretty. The lamiums we tend to get, Lamium galeobdalon, which is the one with the silvery netting on the foliage. Ooh. Anyway, there's one with
John
silvery netting.
John knows.
We've got one called Herman's Pride.
That's
which
the one.
Is,
that's the one.
More of an upright one.
Yeah.
But yeah, lovely.
They're quite vigorous, aren't they, those?
That would do it.
They cope with the dry shade.
Beacon silver.
And then pop some cyclamen in as well.
Yeah.
Cyclamen cuum and Neapolitanum or Heterifolium. I mean, I always get to this time of year. I know it sounds grim because we haven't really had much of a summer. But I'm always looking forward to autumn at this time of year. And the first signs of autumn for me are those first few flowers that you see, which are like beautiful piped sugar flowers that pop up from cyclamen heterifolium, and they are a real joy. And then they have foliage that comes later. They're really good, so those are good for dotting around in amongst all the other things.
And the other thing that would do well under there is the little galliums, Gallium odoratum, with clusters of tiny, very tiny white starry flowers in the spring, and that makes a good ground colour too. And if they do get to be sort of over vigorous and overwhelming, they're very easy to manage. So I think dry shade or that kind of shade is really good. And if you get a position that is really, really difficult, then what you can do is to put a seating area then and then put containers in there.
Yeah.
So you avoid the soil problem. So if it defeats all your best efforts, make a seating area out of forest bark or stone chipping, something like that, and then grow plants in containers and just avoid the problem. So it's a win-win situation.
I think the highlight really for me is the fact that people think there's nothing to grow in dry shade. In actual fact, there's a lot that will grow in dry shade. So I just throw into the mix Euonymus, Radicans, Emerald Gaiety, which is good for dry shade, which is, has a very white variegation, which actually acts as a bit of an uplighter. I have an analogy where, and I've spoken on Rutland and Stamford Sound about it before, actually, which I like, which are plants that grow in a bucket of concrete in the cupboard under the stairs, because it makes people understand they're that easy. You know, and one of those that falls into that category is Lazula nivea, which will grow in the deeper shade. The other plant that I was going to mention is the elephant's ears, so Begonia. Yeah. And I know to the panel here this is going to come as a massive surprise, because I've never come across anybody that's happened to before, but I actually spoke to a lady once who killed one. And I was astounded, because you can't kill a Begonia, you know, wherever you plant it. And I told her she'd murdered it. But anyway, they're just a few to throw in the mix, and I think there are still lots of others that
there's
you can grow as ground cover.
You
know, there's a long list. I think people get a little bit depressed by it, but in actual fact, if you do your research, and as you're doing today, ask the experts, you know, you start to amass a list, and then you'll find the things you like. The other one really, which is a little bit more upright, but sort of creates ground cover, I suppose, that goes with the ones that David and Matt were talking about, are hellebores, the hybridous hellebores. You know, and then you get some winter interest there as well. You know, and it's about creating interest at all different times of the year.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. I noted you. So the other question was. What do we do with slugs that we pick up? Anybody want to start there? David looks
so
keen to
go there. I'm always a big defender of slugs, and I know that sounds like a problem to most people. The ones you see are generally the ones that are demolishing woody material in your garden, because they're big, they've got good jaws, and they can chew away at woody remains, so they're actually helping rot down and break down the material. You very rarely see the big ones hanging off a leaf. Have you ever seen it? But you see lots of lacy curtain leaves, don't you? And that's the little babies, the little slugs that do most of their damage during the night and crawl up while it's dark and moist and nosh away at the leaves. So you're actually persecuting the big grown-ups, and it's actually the babies that need the persecution. So my friend goes round, I don't, my friend goes round with a little yogurt pot and collects them all, and then takes a walk down a footpath with the dog and takes them off to somewhere on the edge of a hedgerow in the countryside and empties them out there. And although snails have been shown to home back to your garden, I have never seen any evidence that slugs do, because they haven't got a portable house on their back, so they have to try and settle in wherever you dump them.
They've got the antennae, though.
They've got the antennae, yeah.
Obviously not working very well.
In. But I would just say that the big ones, which are the easy things to see, aren't they? They're the ones that don't do the damage. So it's the little ones you need to beware of, as always. It's the little ones that do the worst. Would you agree with me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would. We don't have a huge slug problem here, do we? But, yeah, the ones that we do find, we'll probably go in a farmer's field.
I think the thing to do is to sort of get your head right about slugs and snails. You know, we've been organic here for nearly 40 years now. And, you know, as David was talking about, the large slugs, they fit into an ecosystem, as do the small ones, because we use those to feed things like the ground beetles, frogs, the birds, and whatever. So it's like I say, it's about getting your head right about the fact that you need to live with a balance. Now, obviously, one of the problems we have now and the way things are going is that the predators are becoming less while the pests are becoming more. And there's a starting to be, we're finding a little bit of an imbalance. But, you know, we use simple things. We don't actually use anything in the ornamental garden here. We leave things to our own devices. And some years we have, you know, problems in that things get attacked that would never normally get attacked, but most years we don't see the problem, do we? Not even on our hostas. The only place we do protect plants is in the productive areas, because we have much greater value obviously on the plants because we're growing them to eat, and there we use wood ash a lot around plants because that clogs up their slime and they can't travel over that, so we use that over susceptible plants. And of course it also adds potash to the soil, so it's a good thing.
That's a really important point to me, is potash is often overlooked as being really beneficial for toughening plants up and making them less palatable. So we often go and buy plant nutrients, erroneously called food. Remember, plants make their own food, but we buy plant nutrients, don't we, in bottles and boxes, and often they've got quite a lot of nitrogen in there, and nitrogen makes plant tissues very soft, whereas potash not only is good for flowers and fruit, but it toughens the foliage up and makes it much less nice for the pests to either eat or stick their stylets in to get the sap out of. So, yeah, potash, really good. The other thing that I really use now and again to protect really vulnerable plants is sheep's wool. So you can buy sheep's wool pellets, or go out in the countryside and collect it off barbed wire fences and put it around your plants, and they can't slime over the texture of the sheep's wool. So.
But if you see a slug in a sheepskin coat, don't buy a car from it. The other thing is, you mentioned potash. Around about this time of year, getting towards the end of summer, I actually feed a lot of my woody plants with that, because it does toughen up the growth to make sure that it matures for the winter. And the overfeeding, as David said, with high nitrogen, so often you see high levels of nitrogen, and of course that makes everything softer, more palatable for pests and diseases, as David has already said. So sort of watch the balance of food. Things like, you know, leave a pile of terracotta pots in a damp area for protection for frogs and toads. I noticed a baby frog behind my shed in a damp area near the water butt, you know, and they're all going to help you. Put a couple of bricks in there for the thrushes to be able to take the snails and break
smash
open
the shells, yeah.
Shells on them. So you can help nature get that balance, and you don't have to use... the head gardener occasionally resorts to use of environmentally friendly slug pellets, but not often, and it's just a matter of learning to live with them. Beer traps early in the year are very good, and if you put your first beer traps out around February, middle to the end of February, then you get the first generation of slugs, and that reduces the population somewhat for later in the year, but you have to do it earlier. And once on Gardener's Question Time, we did a test of different beers for this, and actually found a use for a non-alcoholic beer made by the same people that make a famous stout. And that was the best of them all. They do actually prefer the stout because they've got more sugar in them as well. So we found a use for it.
The thing not to do, though, is to put either the beer trap Or if you do resort to slug pellets, you know how some people sprinkle them around like pepper? If you are going to use any sort of pellet, which I don't use and I wouldn't suggest you do, or if you're going to make a beer trap, position it away from the plant that you're trying to protect, so that you're drawing the slugs and the snails away from the plants. If you sprinkle slug pellets around the plant, thinking that you're going to protect it, you will just attract them in that direction, and then those that don't succumb will go on and chew your plants. So it's draw them away from your plants rather than attracting them to them.
The other thing is that, I mean, Dave has just alluded to this, but you're not sort of mining the area, as it were, putting landmines down to stop them. If you look on the container, it's something like one pellet every 15 centimetres or 12 centimetres. So they are sort of just dotted around. And I must stress that I do use environmentally friendly slug pellets as a last resort. And slug picking, I think, is a great idea. And you can, you know, lay down sheets of, you know, cut fertiliser sacks and they will go under there. You put the empty half of a grapefruit and they will go under there. Or the little piles of organic matter like lettuces and that they will go there. So there are ways of trapping them to get rid of them and disposing of them. But I somehow think that life's too short to be trapping slugs when they could be food for ground beetles, food for the other parts of the ecosystem that they support.
And be patient. I mean, if you are going to gradually wean yourself off those sorts of chemicals, which I would urge everybody to do, it will take 3, 4, 5 years for it to settle into a natural balance when you get the frogs and the toads and the birds and everything helping you out. And I really don't use any of those things anymore at all. I did very early on in my career. Don't do any of it now, haven't done for about 30 years, and my garden's in a complete natural balance. Most of it, I have to say, inspired by your dad. So, Jeff.
It's interesting though, isn't it, slugs, where you actually see them. So we often see slugs and snails on the window instead of, you know, draw the curtains in the morning, and there, you know, giving you a little early morning wave is a slug. But the most unusual place I've ever seen a slug was on the ceiling of a gent's toilet. And there it was, sort of crawling across. Goodness me. So now you know the secrets of gents' toilets, because they all stand there looking up. And that's where I spotted the slug.
My most unusual place was on the windscreen of my car, because my car is a little bit like a compost heap inside. And I get them crawling across the windscreen inside. And you can see the slimy trails across you when it steams up, you know, early in the morning. There we go.
Well, thank you. Right, question for the gentleman here.
I'm sure it's a common problem. Peat-free compost, having a lot of trouble over the last 3 years with all commercial brands. Can it be augmented in any way to make it a bit more amenable for domestic use? I mean, commercially, you probably have to buy big bales and pallets of stuff from suppliers. But as a domestic user, is there any way we can make it a bit more buffered? Stop it drying out at the top and rotting underneath, which is what seems to happen. Any advice? You've been in the game for a long time. So
I think David actually has a lot of very good advice about peat-free compost, because I've heard you talk about it before.
Okay. So I think we all as gardeners need to relearn the lessons of the Victorians, that they knew a lot about mixing compost, making compost for growing specific plants. And I started my career at Holcombe Hall in Norfolk. Does anybody know Holcombe? And we didn't buy any bags of compost there at all on the nursery. We would use a mixture of leaf mould out of the woods. We'd use our own homemade garden compost, and we would mix that with soil, good quality soil, and we would mix it with grit and make up suitable compost for each type of plant we grew. Over the last 70 years, we've been lulled into a false sense of security by being able to buy peat-based and then, more latterly, multi-purpose compost, which was the biggest misnomer on the planet. There really isn't such a thing as a multi-purpose compost that will be good for seeds, for cuttings, for growing, for potting, for succulents, for fuchsias, for, you know, it's just ridiculous. But we were lulled into using it because it worked most of the time. And it was very easy to buy a bag of compost based on peat, empty it out and grow stuff in it. And that's because of the structure of peat and the fact that it rots down fairly slowly. Once it's exposed to the air, it rots down and it retains its structure for a long time. Now, all the peat-free composts are effectively based on green waste or forestry waste or sometimes agricultural waste, and they've been rotted down to create a texture rather like peat. It's not really, but they're trying to emulate it. But it often has bits of half-decomposed wood in it, you know, all sorts of stuff in it. And effectively, what you're using when you use that green waste compost and all those other peat-free composts, effectively, is a compost heap. You're filling your pot with a compost heap. It's partially decomposed organic matter, and it will continue to break down. And the difference with peat was that it was much, much slower to break down in the pot. So the structure stayed in the pot for a long time. So my advice would be to use that peat-free compost as a compost constituent and mix it in equal parts just to start with, and then experiment with the different proportions, but mix it in equal parts by volume with loam, good quality loam that you can buy in bags, or your own garden soil if it's good enough. Mix it in equal proportions and use that in the way that nature uses it in the soil. Because when you look at a cross-section of the soil, the organic matter is on the surface, which is the equivalent of peat-free compost, and the mineral matter is at the bottom, and that comes from the rocks underneath. And the point where those two mix together makes good soil. And that's what you're trying to emulate with the compost that you use to pot your things up into. So use a mixture of organic matter and mineral matter from loam or good quality soil. Mix them together and you will have much better results that will be longer lasting, have a lot more beef and substance in it for the plants, and you'll get much better results.
Excellent. I would like to add to that that my approach is sort of similar but different, in that I have peat-free multi-purpose compost, and I often check out to see which have been recommended in their trials. And I know there's always limitations with trials, but by which each year, because composts vary. So one year, you know, one compost can be excellent, another year because of their sources, and it's not quite so good. So I get something that has been recommended within certain parameters. So I get that, and then I look at the plant that I want to grow, think, where does it come from? Where's its native habitat? What does it like? So sometimes that needs a little bit of research. And then I add either sharp sand, grit, loam, whatever else. So I get my organic matter from the multi-purpose, having picked the bits out sometimes, and then just make my own recipe according to where the plant comes from. So if it's cacti, for example, then it will be heavy on horticultural grit or sharp sand, so that it's actually free draining. The multi-purpose is the core, if you like, and then all the other added ingredients just go in according, but I really must stress, according to the habitat of the plant, and that seems to work quite well. I don't use my garden soil because we're on clay with flints, and even with the addition of well-rotted organic matter, which the late and still lamented Jeff Hamilton, your dad, said, I will always remember, and I hope I remembered it correctly as well, that it takes 15 years to make a clay soil into something good, but the basis, you know, is there, and that's with the addition of well-rotted organic matter and improving the soil. So, yeah, so I don't use my garden soil, but I do buy in.
And I think that's the key, isn't it? Tailoring your growing medium, if you like, to suit the plants that you want to grow is something that gardeners have done for hundreds and hundreds of years. Over the last 70 years, we've just ignored that and gone away and bought a bag of peat compost. And fortunately or unfortunately, it grew most things decently. But we've just got to relearn those lessons. And there's no such thing as being able to go and buy a bag of compost that will suit everything these days. The only other thing I would add, just quickly, is the only one that I found that I quite like that almost gets towards a peat-based compost is the Lakeland products, the ones that are based on sheep's wool and bracken. And they're expensive, but if you want in small quantities, if you want to grow things in that, they are better, much better.
Yeah, and I sort of mix and match, and I use the Dale for it, and also Melcourt I've found to be excellent as well. And you know, I was about to interrupt you, David, and say something, and I've forgotten what I was going to say.
So Dalesfoot is the same as the Lakeland stuff. So one of the Dalesfoot products is called Lakeland Gold, and that's a really useful basis for things like seed and cuttings composts that I use.
Yeah. But, yeah. And quite often there's the addition of, this wasn't what I was going to tell you, but I'll tell you this one anyway, but I quite often use the fine milled forest bark. That's really good to improve drainage. It's still not what I wanted to say.
I actually use Melcourt here. I think from what you get from talking to people, I think that in horticulture or gardening or whatever you want to call it generally, people have things that work well for them and they don't work well for their neighbour, and what works well for their neighbour doesn't work well for them, but that doesn't mean the product is bad. It's just the fact that it just seems to happen like that, where people have their favourite seed company, they have their favourite compost company. We've tried the wall compost, we don't get on well with it. That's just us. I use Melcourt, and that's what we use here. I think the big lesson is that we have relied too heavily on peat-based compost for way too many years, and I think that it is now about relearning. It's about experimenting until we find things. It's about understanding what the new compost and therefore the new mixes that you make, what they do. And, you know, our Melcourt here that we have, it is the same thing in that it looks dry on the top, but in actual fact it's wet underneath. But it's just trying to understand, and it's also very important to understand what your index finger was made for. And that is to stick in a pot to see how damp it is.
We don't do that, do we? We often say, oh, well, one way of finding out, you know, said it myself, but how many times do I actually do it? I think I did it last week when it suddenly thought, oh, yeah, that's right, that's what you can do with it. And if you feel, and if you can't quite sort of detect by feel, that if when you pull your finger out and there's fragments of compost stuck to it, then you know that it's damp enough. One of the good things about these composts drying out at the surface I have found this week is that I have an aubergine, which is low on the plant, obviously growing big now, but because the top of the compost dries out quickly, I don't have to put anything underneath it to protect it from there. So it's actually sitting on a very nice little comfy duvet of dry compost without me having to worry about it rotting off at the end. But that was this week's bonus in the garden.
I think the watering aspect of compost is always something that people find difficult, and we get asked an awful lot here about how often to water things, and the answer is always the same. You water when you need to. It's impossible to tell people a definitive, you must water this 3 times a week or whatever, because the weather has such an impact on that, and the new compost will retain water or not, totally differently to the way that peat did.
Can I just add one other thing? That when you first use a peat-free compost, I tend to sieve mine to get rid of all the big lumps and all the big bits of half-decomposed whatever. When you first fill a pot up, it's fine for the first couple of weeks. But have you noticed the way the level drops? And that's because it's a compost heap you've just filled your pot with. So if you add more loam to it, it will retain its structure for longer. But just to your point, Nick, the watering will change as that compost decomposes. So initially you'll need to water it in a certain way, but as it decomposes and rots down and the level goes down, the structure of that compost changes dramatically, and your watering regime has to change according to that change in the compost. So that's why I think it's really important as domestic gardeners that for longer term growing it during the rest of the year, that we add loam to our composts, because I think it's much more long-term and sustainable, and it takes all the guesswork out of watering.
Where do you get good quality loam?
I use either my soil, which isn't bad, it's not the best, but it's not bad, or you can buy at a well-known DIY store. I went and bought some yesterday. Bags of topsoil, that they call it topsoil, that you use for laying turf. But you and I and all of us would probably have called that loam in one time or another. Make sure it comes from a reliable source. So loam is just simply good quality topsoil. Get it from a reliable source. Don't get it cheap in a big load from somebody down the road, because you don't know where it's come from. So there are really good reliable sources of loam. Get it from somewhere where it's commercially available. There is even a British standard, believe it or not, for topsoil that specifies it. So you can also ask whether this topsoil conforms to British standards. If it doesn't, if they can't prove that it does, don't go near it. Because I once bought some that was full of nettle seeds and full of all sorts of rubbish that I didn't discover until I'd put it on the garden. So there we go.
But you were able to use the nettles for
The nettles,
liquid feed.
Yeah.
The nettles I'm still battling with about 18 years on. Anyway,
good.
There you go.
I mean, to be fair, they're good for beneficial insects as well, aren't they? So, I mean, you're doing your bit at the end of the day. Right, I think we've got time for one quick question, if anybody's got another question.
Could I ask the panel's opinions on no-mo? Because I go to a lot of lovely gardens like this and stately homes, and there's acres and acres and acres of mown grass, and I'm thinking, surely if you let a lot of the grass grow, you'd be helping pollinators, which are just disappearing. So I'm just interested in what you think about that.
We have areas here that we allow to go wild. Whatever wants to grow there can. And then we cut those down sort of August, September time. So I agree that, yeah, these big expanses of lawns that we mow weekly, you could allow them to go wild like that. But you will need a suitable piece of equipment to cut that down when it's time. You won't be able to do it with your mower, and obviously there'll be a lot of seed as well that can come from that, which might end up all over your garden. So I think my view is there's a balance of let bits be wild, but you need some degree of control, or your borders would soon fill up with weeds, I think, if we allowed that everywhere. But it's a great idea, certainly, to encourage all kinds of insects and wild flowers into your garden. Some of the areas that we've let go wild, orchids have appeared just from nowhere. So, yeah, certainly agree with it, but not everywhere.
Matt, you want to add to?
Yeah, I think the compromise between it is raising the cut of your mower to a couple of inches, and then you'll get the low-growing wildflowers like the ajugas. They will flower probably a little bit later on. You'll get the achillea will pop up. I just think raising the cut actually will help, and leaving the daisies and seeing daisies as pretty. In my front garden, I've got a lot of apple cordons. It'd be too posh to call it an orchard, so I'll say it's a collection of apples. And we allow that to grow up. So in the spring, for example, I've planted Narcissus bulbicodium because it gets quite wet. So I've actually added to it. Then it goes through sort of the oxeye daisies. At the moment, the knapweeds are there, and it will be cut probably end of August. My problem is that, of course, when you cut, you have all that grass, you know, to dispose of, and, you know, put some of it on the compost heap, and you have then been providing a habitat for something, you know, until August, and then suddenly they go, who's got rid of my house? You know, where's my habitat gone? You know, and that is one of the difficulties, I think, of making a large habitat. There's lots of insect activity, the butterflies come through, it's fabulous to watch. So as a habitat, it's great, but, you know, cutting it early, I think, does them a disservice because they are suddenly homeless. So I think the best compromise is to either have little patches of wildflowers, as has already been said, dotted around the garden, along perhaps some boundaries, along the edges of borders or of paths so people can enjoy them. Or the other thing to do is to just raise the cut on the lawnmower. But I'm still trying to work through in my own mind the benefit of having a large area like I've got at the front, leaving it, saying, hey, here it is, come on in, make your home here, and then, you know, at the end of August or so, cutting it back. The real time to do it would be later on when they've gone to other places to hibernate the insects or finish their life cycle. So I think perhaps my solution, unless my colleagues on the panel have a brighter idea, have a light bulb moment, is just sort of leaving it till September when it would naturally die back.
I don't know whether you find it at Barnsdale, but I know that another friend of mine who has a garden that's open to the public, they tried known mow May, and loads of people criticised them for not having short grass. So it's, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. You know, you'd get criticised for cutting the grass shorter or criticised for leaving it longer. The other thing to say is that just having no mow May is fine in May, but then what happens in the run-up to May and then what happens after May? You know, it's trying to be as generous to wildlife and as generous to the environment as you possibly can be. And also leaving the grass longer, as Matt suggests, you know, a higher cut means that the grass roots go down deeper. So for the longer grass on the surface, you'll find that proportionately underground, the roots will go down deeper. Now, the benefit of that is that it makes the grass more drought tolerant. It also helps to keep the structure of the soil open. So if you get heavy rain, it soaks in well into the soil rather than running off on a well-trodden short sward. It also allows lots of things like the ones Matt has already mentioned, including clover. Clover is a really useful plant for wildlife, and clover, when it comes into flower, will be really beneficial for bees and other pollinators. So leaving it longer, brilliant. Letting the roots go down deeper, yep. But sort of managing it is what you need to do. And there's nothing wrong in having much longer bits of grass that you leave that do create this meadowy look, but it will create a very different look to your garden. And we're sat here on this well manicured lawn here. If you can imagine all of it being long and all of it, you know, looking at middle of the summer sort of a bronzy browny colour, with trying to offset the borders with that sort of sward, it just doesn't work in the same way. So the green shorter grass is a really useful foil for the borders that it is in between, if you see what I mean. So it's, yeah, a mix is good.
Could I just say that if you have sort of grandchildren or youngsters coming round, when the clover is in flower, just watch them, because they can run around and get stung by the bees when they're running around. So just, you know, bear that in mind. Look, if you're,
yes, well. Therefore I will add that when we finish this, you start running around. I'm just looking at clover over there in the grass, and we have lots of it. And I remember somebody, obviously many, many years ago, because my dad passed away 28 years ago today, actually, and he was once commented, a visitor, when we had this part of the garden open initially, he was wandering down here and a visitor stopped him and he said, I'm very disappointed with the grassy areas down here, Jeff. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, there's an awful lot of clover in it. And he said, where? He said, over there somewhere, pointing. And my dad said to him, well, it's green and you can't see it from here and it's actually tougher than grass, so what's your problem? You know, and it's good for beneficial insects, you know, and it is. And I think that, I mean, we don't necessarily scalp our grass because it tends to cope better with people's feet just slightly longer, fractionally longer. Also, we do get comments from people when our wildflower areas are left to seed, which is what we should be doing. And I've always said, as I said earlier on about getting your head straight, you know, I say to people, and it's the same with rose black spot in a bad year and all those sort of things that we cope with, you know, if there's an area that looks bad, don't look at it, is the answer. You know, if it depresses you, don't look at it. And I do that with roses because we're organic, you know, we cope. We're also in a bit of a blight black spot area here, and so I enjoy the flowers of roses and I don't look at the black spot because that depresses me, but the flowers elate me, you know, so I do that. I think that, you know, we curate our gardens and we have been doing that for decades and centuries, really. And, you know, garden is your own space. The difference we have here is that we're saying to people, come into our own space. So we sort of have to accommodate that to a degree. But David's right, you know, some people are very narrow-minded in the way that they look at things. And I think if we left grass here to grow longer, we would have to cut pathways through, which for us is difficult because it restricts, therefore, where people will go, because they have to go where the pathway takes them. And the great thing for us is that, you know, we have some hard pathways and things that we put in, artificial pathways. But generally with the grass, you say to people that, you know, this is a grass area, go in whatever direction you want. And so for us, that works well. And I think you need to look at that for your own home. It's about having a balance between, you know, what's best and what you want. I think the no-mow May thing is a bit gimmicky, to be honest. You know, you need to think further ahead than just that 1 month.
I think that a lot of people use their lawn areas as space to entertain or to kick a football or, you know, and if it's all wild, you almost have to stay off it. So it depends what room you have, what you can allow to go wild, maybe.
I should now think, Nick, of my roses wearing a leopard skin print.
Could I also put a plea out to everybody to try and disengage your tidiness gene? Because I think that's one of the other problems. So many of us, as human beings, we're as a species, we are very controlling and we are very much hardwired into things being needed to be tidied. And if we can just leave that to one side, that will help wildlife enormously. So leaving grass a bit longer, not cutting borders back too early, you know, trying to get this natural world back in balance is what's really important.
Yeah, we tend to, with our wildflower areas that we have by the Memorial Garden area there, and when we cut that back later in September, John's team now mound that, lay that at the back of the wildflower border as a place for things to hibernate.
Yeah.
And so it's repurposing it. And yes, it looks like cut back wildflower area mounded up at the back of the fence. But, you know, it's about understanding what you're trying to do. The difficulty for us, I think, is, you know, if people ask, we'll tell. You know, and that's the thing. And we are all continually being educated. So it's always best, rather than jump into a conclusion, to ask first. You know, it's always a good way to learn. Well, thank you all for that. We've had a fantastic range of questions, and thank you very much. And thank you very much for the panel for some excellent answers. And we've all gone away, including myself, educated. Thank you. Thank you.